Council, are you ready to proceed? Okay, then I will call our first case for the day, State versus Braunschweig. Please proceed, Council.
May it please the Court, Council. My name is Michael Witt, and it's my privilege to honor Justin Braunschweig's case to this court this morning. I know that Mr. Braunschweig, who's working today, would join me in thanking you for the opportunity to have his case heard by this court. The fact that a young working person can hire a Main Street lawyer and get his case all the way up to this court is a credit to the system in Wisconsin. There are two primary questions I'm going to be asking the court to address in its decision, and those two questions may or may not raise a third. The first question is, can an expunged prior conviction be used as a predicate prior in an OWI case? The second question that needs to be addressed is, regardless of whether that prior is to be proved at sentencing or whether it's to be proved at trial, what is the burden of proof that the state must carry in proving that prior? I would argue on the first point that in the absence of a clear legislative directive to exempt OWI convictions from the full benefit of the expunction statute, that the answer to that first question should be no, that question should be answered in Mr. Braunschweig's favor. As to the second question...
Counsel, what is the full benefit of the expunction statute to which you referred?
The full benefit of the expunction statute to which I refer is the benefit that this court concluded applied to the expunction statute in the Leitner case, which includes not having that expunged conviction used as a predicate for an enhancer. I would concede that the court in that case was addressing a separate enhancer statute or penalty statute. However, that case was a criminal traffic case, and the same definition of conviction that we'll be arguing about here today would have applied to that case as well, just sort of from the flip side. In terms of that first question, I think that the standard of review on that question, as well as the other question, is de novo. I think they're questions of law. As to the counting of the prior, this wasn't a sentencing decision. This was raised by motion in advance of trial and decided by the circuit court prior to conviction. So this wasn't a sentencing determination by the circuit court.
Does it affect the sentencing determination?
Pardon me?
Does it affect the sentencing determination?
Certainly does. Absent the prior conviction, this wouldn't be a crime at all, and there would be no criminal sentence.
All right. So it affects the sentencing determination, but the determination wasn't made in sentencing.
That's correct. My argument would be you'd never get to a criminal sentencing if you can't use this prior, because this would be a forfeiture offense. There would be no criminal prosecution.
Right. Judges have to determine what offense it is before you even try a case, because it carries with it potentially different penalties and different elements the jury has to find. I mean, if you are at a certain level, the breath alcohol concentration would be less. Right.
That's true, but in that instance, that is a status element, which is not for the judge ultimately, but it's for the jury.
Right.
So in a PAC case for a fourth or subsequent currently, the law used to be the difference between 1-0 and 0-8. That was the Alexander case. But currently, ultimately, that's a status element for the jury, and that would bring us to both the burden and the third question.
Right. So to know where you fit within that paradigm, you need to know what number of offense it is before you even begin a trial.
That's true between a third and a fourth, and between a first and a second. Once you get beyond four, the determination is made, and until you get past one, it's
not. But in a practical matter, you need to know before you begin.
That's
so
true.
You know how to instruct a jury, what the burden of proof is, what the, you know, how to advise someone of the potential penalties, what elements the jury has to determine. I mean, those, at least in my experience, you determine that before you go too much further.
The only way I'm hedging is agreeing completely with determine, because in those status element cases, the judge has to decide what instructions to give the jury.
That's right.
And there is a pattern instruction, but the ultimate determination on whether that prior has been proven or not is for the jury.
That's
not the court.
Well, I don't know if it's whether the prior is, but what the element is can be dependent on what number offense it is.
I would argue that under Alexander, that, and if you look at the standard instruction that I cite in my brief, the jury is actually instructed that the question on whether or not the predicate priors exist is for them on those O2 PAC cases. I believe it's 2660C.
Okay. Here the instruction was the second offense, right?
That's correct. And point of fact, there was no jury instruction here because we actually stipulated to try this issue to the court, as quite frankly did Mr. Van Rijpel in the other case that we're going to be talking about here. The question was simply the ability to use that expunged prior. And we agreed to do a court trial to preserve the issue rather than have a jury instructed.
What is it you want this court to do?
Two things. I want this court to argue that as it said, or to find that as it said in McAllister, which is the decision that originally said that the prior isn't an element in an OWI case, that this is just another repeater statute. And then I want to take your decision in Leitner, which says that the expunged conviction cannot be used as a predicate in a repeater enhancer. So I think if you take the starting point as McAllister, which is what this court said previously, this is just like any other repeater statute, and what this court said in Leitner, which is that the full benefit of expunction includes not being able to use that expunged prior to enhance. That's what I want this court to do. I think that secondly, I want this court to clarify the burden of proof, whether at sentencing or at trial, on all predicates, because the McAllister case left that open, and I believe the state in its brief conceded that that is a question of first impression for this
Counsel, court. Before we get on to the second issue, you said during oral argument and you said in your brief that the conviction was expunged, but in fact the conviction wasn't expunged. It was the record, the court record. I think there's a difference there, don't you?
I think that it depends how you're defining conviction. For a criminal code conviction, which is what this is, the criminal conviction was expunged. Now we're going to get into parsing the language of 340.019R. And I think that if you look at that, you can't just read the body of the statute. You have to look at sections A through D, where the legislature set forth examples of things that it meant would count other than.
Before we do that, I'm looking at the expunction statute. It says the court may order at the time of sentencing that the record be expunged. But the conviction itself is not, right? It still exists in other records, such as the Department of Transportation, law enforcement records. It's the court record that's expunged.
And that's where, I'm not trying to be argumentative, but that's a fine distinction that I don't want to concede, because in a criminal conviction, there is a judgment of conviction. That is the conviction. That is because of the higher standard of proof requirements that apply to other repeater enhancers is what the state would need. When the legislature relaxed those proofs in the 50s for OWI cases to facilitate OWI prosecutions, they said competent proof is good enough.
Are you equating expunction with vacation?
I am not.
Okay.
Counsel, you know, I have a more basic problem. You're asking that we conclude that the prior OWI, which is a first offense OWI, it falls under the statute, but it wasn't a criminal conviction.
Actually,
so how do you fall underneath the statute? You can explain that to us.
I can, actually. And there's actually no factual dispute there. I believe that as the record in that case establishes, that was actually, it was a first offense, but because there was an injury involved, it was a criminal case. The issue was decided as a criminal case. The judge in Jackson County weighed the competing policy objectives set forth by the legislature in 967055 and 973015 in terms of, on the one hand, giving a youthful offender a second start, a clean slate, and on the other hand, vigorous prosecution. And it's my argument that when you read those two statutes together, that evinces a legislative determination to leave that policy weighing to the circuit judge who grants or doesn't grant expunction. But it was a case that falls under the statute because of the injury.
Okay, so if there were no injury, then the argument that you're making today wouldn't have any application? Is that what you're also saying?
It would have never been brought because the case could not have been eligible for expunction in the first instance. So it was only
right.
The fact.
Okay, all right, good.
So, counsel, if vacator is not the same thing as expunged, expunction, what is the difference?
The difference, I think, is As has been pointed out in some of the other questions, a vacated conviction goes to the merits. The conviction records still exist, but the court has taken steps to vacate that conviction, so the original judgment of conviction would be vacated. I think expunction destroys all those court records, so I think it's a distinction. I have to concede is a distinction with a difference.
When you look at Leitner, which you're relying on, in that situation, the court was looking at the repeater statute, and the language there is of record and unreversed, as opposed to the language here when we look at prior convictions, and the language in the 340.019R, a conviction is an unvacated adjudication of guilt. So when we look at the distinction there that the legislature made, couldn't they have said of record and unreversed? Couldn't they have said unvacated? Or vacated, when we look at the language there, that's what the comparison that we have to look at.
I think it's important to point out here that that statute was not argued to or presented to the trial court. The actual counting statute for OWIs is 343.307, and then you actually move to the conviction definition under 340.019R.
But nowhere in 34 in this code. Is there any language that's similar to that in the repeater statute? And nowhere does it talk about vacation. It talks about the record. And expunction is as we were talking before, about vacated versus expunging the record, right?
That's true, but give me a second, because I wouldn't say nowhere. I believe there was a section argued at the lower level that does make a distinction.
There was one section argued that shows that that was a section that the legislature actually had a choice between vacation or expungement, in which case the legislature seems to know the difference between the two and chose not to use the language here, right?
Could I ask what statute the court is referring
to? That one is 973.015 sub 2M. And that was what was argued in the briefs.
I would actually disagree. First, what I was going to refer to in terms of the record language was 340.01.48M, which when we're talking about some of these other things that are counted under 9R, refers to the record of conviction as the report of conviction furnished to the department by a tribal court or by the court of another state. So I think that seizing on the conviction definition and then peeling it apart to look for the expunction exception is, quite frankly, giving the legislature too much credit. I think that if 973.015 was meant to not cover these things, A, they would expressly have said it there, or in 967.055. If you look at both of those statutes, they list things that should not be done without a finding. And then I think that they limit, by enumeration, what uses the retained DOT record can be put to, meaning they refer to the specific retention under 343.23. And if you look at 343.23B, it spells out the purposes for which the secretary can use those retained records.
That's the purpose, but it's not a limitation on what they can use it for, is it?
I think it is. If you look at the argument that was just inherent in the question I was asked last, what did the legislature determine? And choosing to go that far and say, not that this doesn't affect DOT records, period, put a period after that statement. They said, for purposes of 343.23. So if you read the entire statute, that statute goes on to limit the purposes for which it's being retained. They're legitimate public safety purposes. It's a logical distinction by the legislature to want that full record available to the secretary for making those determinations under 343.23B, but it doesn't say anything about expunction.
Is there part of the language of that statute to which you would refer to say that these are the exclusive purposes for which that record can be used?
I would read sub B, the lead-in on sub B there, when it says the records retained under A and AM, which isn't relevant to this argument. It spells out specifically what they're retained for.
Okay. Give me the language of exclusiveness.
Certainly.
From that statute.
I'll read it. I've got it tabbed, anticipating a question of the sort. So 343.23 sub 1, which is what's referred to in the expunction statute, which is 973.015, has a general read-in, and those are the records that aren't expunged. If you then look at sub 2, sub, where is it? I'm wondering if there was a change in the statute. I've got it cited in my brief. I'm going to cheat and look at my brief because I'm having trouble with my statute book. I quoted it en bloc in the reply. It's 343.23. Sub 2, sub A is the retention paragraph, and then sub 2, sub B says the information specified in paragraphs A, which is what we're talking about, and AM must be filed by the department, consistent with the earlier statute, so that the complete operator's record is available for the use of the secretary in determining whether the operating privileges of such person shall be suspended, revoked, and then it goes on to list other purposes for public safety. So I'm arguing that language that we're retaining this for the use of the secretary distinguishes it from the record of conviction, which is expunged.
But it doesn't, so I'm trying to figure out where in that language the exclusivity of purposes exists, because the language you just read to me suggests that the legislature said, here's the reason that we think it's important that the record is retained for these purposes.
Correct.
But there doesn't seem to be any language in there that says, and it can't be used for any other reason.
I would agree. I guess, so to try and answer your question another way, what I'm arguing is that by incorporating that statute and that statute alone into the expunction statute, they're saying that we're saying this doesn't affect DOT records for the purposes of 343.23. They could have just as easily said for the purposes of counting under 343.307 or written a sub E to 340.019R that says expunged cases count as convictions, but they didn't do that. I think once we start looking that deeply for an exception to the general purpose of the expunction statute,
well, do we need to look at the purpose of the expunction statute? I mean, it tells us what it does, right? It expunges the court's record.
True.
And that's all it does.
And in construing the effect of that statute in State versus Leitner, this court said it does a number of other things, including precluding the use of an expunged conviction as an as a predicate in a repeater statute.
Well, What language do you have specifically for that proposition?
From Leitner?
Yes.
I can get that for Your Honor. I've got it quoted at 2002 WI 77, mm-hmm. paragraph 39.
Yep.
Talks about the benefits of expunction. Mm-hmm. It's cited on page 6 of my principal brief to this court. Expunction of a court record of conviction enables an offender to have a clean start so far as the prior conviction is concerned, not the record of the conviction. As the state points out in the Leitner case, expunging the court record provides substantial advantages to the offender. And then I put this in bold. An expunged record of a conviction cannot be considered at a subsequent sentencing. And then skipping over the impeachment language, I also bold in my brief, it says, this court said, and an expunged record of conviction is not available for repeater sentence enhancement. So yeah. When you look at this court saying the record of conviction cannot be used.
Right. So that, I've got that bolded in my notes as well. But it's referring to the court's record, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. Leitner was a criminal traffic case, but the underlying conviction that they were using to enhance was a straight criminal case, so I guess I would have to say that's a question that this court would have to address.
Right. So in the way we would address this is, I think, going back to the question of whether expunction is the same thing as vacator. Because if Leitner stands for the proposition that you're advancing, then doesn't that change expunction to a vacator?
I would argue no, because the only where that language, that distinguishing language appears, is in the criminal code, or not in the criminal code, excuse me, that's completely wrong, in the traffic code definition of conviction. So the traffic code uses an expansive definition of conviction. Most criminal traffic cases are not criminal.
Right. But before we get there, I want to focus on this difference between expunction and vacator.
I'm sorry. I just want to put a placeholder here. I want to get to the second issue. So after you finish this, I'll ask a question on the second issue.
So if Leitner does what you say, if expunction does what Leitner says you say it does, is there anything left for vacator to do? What if we decided, well, this conviction needs to be vacated? What would that do in addition to what you say Leitner has already done through expunction?
All the things that Leitner reserves for the state with regard to an expunged conviction. Being able to refer to the underlying record from the district attorney's files or the DOT files. I'm not saying it can't be argued at sentence that this previous incident occurred. So Leitner, and then there's a follow-on case that even I think expands it further, and the name is escaping me, reserve a whole lot of uses for the state on an expunged conviction. I think vacator would take those off the table. So I'm not asking the court to go that far. I'm simply asking the court to apply Leitner in this case, the same as it did in Leitner's case.
Okay. Thanks. Let's turn to the burden of proof for the predicate offense. You're asserting that it's beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yes.
And give me your best argument. The state instead posits that it's preponderance of evidence, as I understand it. So tell me what you rely on for reasonable doubt.
First of all, I submitted an unpublished decision, flagged it as unpublished, where the Court of Appeals did address this question, trying to reconcile the dichotomy between it being a status element, the prior being a status element in a case where O2 applies, and only for sentencing in a case in all OWI cases, even if it's a case where the jury decides the status element. And I think that the best argument is Van Riper clearly says that beyond a reasonable doubt is the burden in those cases where the predicate is used to trigger the lower PAC. Those cases are all going to be tried with an OWI, which if this court chooses not to revisit McAllister, and the facts of this case may not be the case that you choose to do that, are going to be for a sentencing judge. So you could have a situation in those cases where you have different burdens of proof applying to charges that are joined by statute. The OWI and PAC must be joined. And I think it's that unique joining scheme that takes this under Apprendi rather than Almendarez-Torres. If you look at what the problem in Apprendi was, it wasn't that they were trying to enhance a penalty for a hate crime. It's that it added a finding that they took away from the jury to essentially double the penalty. And it was the scheme, not the penalty enhancer, that triggered the requirement that it go to a jury in Apprendi. So I would argue that our unique pairing scheme under the statute, all OWIs and PACs must be tried together. I would argue that that pulls us closer to Apprendi than Almendarez-Torres. And then reserving the argument, of course, that McAllister made and lost, it's also the difference between a crime and not a crime in this case.
Are there any states that do apply beyond a reasonable doubt standard in this type of situation that you know of? I know that there wasn't a lot cited here on either side in terms of, well, a little bit from the state cited, clear and convincing, preponderance.
I looked at those, and those aren't helpful. Those are for the general scheme, meaning deciding whether the prior counts at sentencing versus a jury issue. So,
well, you're always going to be, I get what you're saying, that this is a unique pairing statute, but whenever you have an element of the offense, it's going to be beyond a reasonable doubt, and you do have that sometimes with PAC, depending on what number it is. But just getting to the standard OWI statute and using those to as a penalty enhancer, essentially, which is what the court has said, what is the basis for us applying that higher burden other than that scheme that you're talking about? Are there other arguments that you have, other states or other persuasive arguments?
No, my argument would be that given the unique scheme, if you don't apply the same burden across the board, you're going to have situations where you've got separate burdens applying based upon these decisions on where the predicates are. In the same case, you're going to have separate burdens. So we know it's got to be beyond a reasonable doubt to the trier of fact in cases where it's a status element.
As the PAC, but then not as the OWI.
And that's my point. So if you decide the burden of proof in any criminal OWI case is less than beyond a reasonable doubt, this case will apply beyond the facts of this case and establish that it applies to all criminal OWI cases. So then in those fourth offense cases, which you're going to see more trial cases given the new law that's taking effect December 1st that's going to disqualify fourth and subsequent offenders for life, more people are going to be taking those to trial. If you don't address this and establish the same burden, you're going to have cases where a jury could find that this isn't a fourth, but the judge could sentence as a fourth anyway.
Applying a different burden.
And I don't think that makes any sense.
What burden was applied here?
The trial court, who's present, initially
applied. Fantastic job.
I miss he did, because he initially agreed with the state that it was a lower burden, but then after thinking about it said, but if it's beyond a reasonable doubt, I find that the proofs were met here. And again, that's why I threw Jewett in. This isn't going to raise some parade of horribles and I have to stop, but this isn't going to be a hard thing. It's not going to change the way the state operates.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Deputy Solicitor General Soap and Shaw for the state of Wisconsin. The legislature chooses which convictions count under the OWI penalty enhancement statute, which increases the penalties for people who repeatedly drive while intoxicated and endanger people in Wisconsin. Under the plain language of the statute, expunged convictions count because they remain unvacated adjudications of guilt.
Are there other things that count as priors other than a conviction for OWI?
I believe so. I believe any determination that an individual has violated a law between, I think, chapters 342 to 349 count. So it doesn't just have to be a criminal conviction. It can also be the forfeiture.
So where would a judge or a prosecutor look to find whether there is something like that that would count as a prior?
The definitions of which convictions count are found in statutes section 343.307. And
for some reason, I'm thinking that failure to follow through on an alcohol assessment or something like that is one example. Is that still the case, or was that the case at the time of this conviction?
That's right, Your Honor. I believe that was correct. The failure to follow through counted at the time of this.
That doesn't count as a prior conviction.
To consent to a blood draw? Is that what we're discussing?
No.
So there's refusals.
Refusals count, correct?
I think that's right. Sorry, that's what I was referring to, Your Honor. Okay. Sorry. My apologies. So you were asking me if there are things other than a prior conviction that count. I think determinations that someone has failed to follow a law. Let me find the statutory language. Right.
That's right. I don't want to take up your time.
Oh, that's okay. Yeah, so it's A, the subsections A through D that count, and this would fall into subsection D, a conviction. Under the law, I'm sorry, Your Honor. But yes, the answer to your question is yes, that there are things other than it.
And those couldn't be, or must, are they all eligible for expunction?
No, I think the expunction applies only to a criminal conviction.
Okay, what kind of record would a court look to for those other kinds of less traditional prior offense violations that would count?
I believe the Department of Transportation maintains records of other jurisdictions' violations. So
the DOT record is what courts use.
That's right. And my understanding is that prosecutors, when looking for prior convictions or violations, search a database linked to Wisconsin Department of Transportation records. And this court has repeatedly approved of sentencing court reliance on those DOT certified records. They're government records. They prove the existence of the conviction, especially in a case like this one where Mr. Braunschweig did not question the validity of his prior conviction. He acknowledged that it did belong to him and that it occurred. And the citations for those concessions are on Appendix 4 and 6. And here, to get to one of counsel's issues that and this court's questions, that expunction and vacatur are not the same thing. Vacatur gets to the validity, the merits of a conviction. As one example of the difference, an offender whose conviction is expunged must still serve his or her sentence, whereas someone whose conviction is vacated no longer has to serve the sentence for that particular conviction. And the benefits of expunction are concededly limited, and that's the legislature's choice to make. Expunction doesn't protect someone from all of the consequences of their conviction. It merely makes it harder for members of the public, for future employers, to discover evidence of that conviction.
Counsel, would it be too simple to explain the difference between expunction and vacatur as expunction eliminates one piece of evidence about the conviction. Vacatur erases the fact of the conviction.
I believe that's a correct characterization, Your Honor. And it makes sense that the legislature, in determining which convictions still count for the OWI penalty enhancement statute, and determining the scope of the relief that expunction gets an offender, that the legislature would choose not to give an OWI recidivist the benefit of a bargain, the benefit of the fresh start bargain that expunction gives you when he has expressly rejected it by his own conduct.
So opposing counsel says that we said in Leitner that after a record of conviction has been expunged, that conviction can no longer be used for purposes of applying a repeater statute. What is your response to that?
So I would focus my response on the statutory language of that general repeater statute. The footnote in the Leitner decision to that paragraph that counsel read that said that an expunged record of conviction cannot be used for the purpose of the general repeater statute, the footnote cites to Section 93962, the general repeater statute, and not the particular language of the OWI penalty enhancement statute. And I think one of your honors honed in on that earlier by saying that the general repeater statute requires that convictions remain of record and unreversed. And here, the language that matters for the OWI penalty enhancement statute is any unvacated adjudication of guilt.
Okay. And so the part of Leitner that opposing counsel focused on related specifically to use in repeater situations. Language further on about uses that we said are preserved include making decisions about repeater charges and making recommendations about sentencing. So what do we mean by that? If expunction takes the prior conviction entirely off the table for purposes of repeaters, then what effect does this have for the district attorney making decisions about repeater charges?
So I would say, Your Honor, that we don't concede that it takes the prior conviction off the table.
I'm just characterizing opposing counsel's argument on that.
Okay. Yes, so obviously this language in the next paragraph in Leitner suggests that an expunged conviction is available for consideration by law enforcement, by the state, by a sentencing judge.
Is the way to harmonize that to say that the court record of conviction cannot be used as proof of the prior conviction for purposes of the repeater, but if proof of the conviction is found elsewhere, that can be used as proof of the prior conviction for a repeater?
I think that's correct, Your Honor, that Leitner focuses on the interpretation of the expunction statute. And according to that statute in Supreme Court Rule 72.06, the court records are either to be deleted or sealed And so using a record that should have been expunged, focusing again on the record, is a violation of the expunction statute and its purposes in that Supreme Court rule.
Can I turn you to the second argument that Mr. Witt was making and ask you for your best argument against why we shouldn't apply that burden of proof standard, especially given his argument with respect to the harmonizing of the two joined OWI and PAC charges that often happens during a criminal trial?
I think this court's McAllister decision controls here, and this court decided that a prior conviction is not an element under the OWI penalty enhancement statute, and that is consistent with United States Supreme Court jurisprudence in Almendarez-Torres. As to the fact that certain cases are joined by statute, I don't believe that requires that that burden of proof apply to charges other than the charge for which the prior conviction is a status element under the Alexander decision. There's no constitutional or statutory requirement. If the legislature has chosen to make a prior conviction a status element in those 0.02 to 0.08 cases, it is a choice, and there's no requirement that we extend that to others.
So the fact that you could have the one burden put to the jury for the PAC with that same conviction and a different burden to the court as whether or not it enhances the number of convictions, that you don't see any issue with that?
I don't think there's a requirement or a problem.
Well, even if there's not a problem, is there potentially an argument that can be made that they should be synthesized, especially given the more severe penalties we're seeing out of the OWI statutes and what that extra conviction enhancement could be? And a lot of those cases you cited look to how many years more you can get and what standard should be applied based on that?
I would say that even under those cases, the sentence increases that troubled a minority of courts, so it was the minority rule, were much larger than the increases that we see under the OWI penalty enhancement statute. And if there is an argument to be made, I think that's an argument to the legislature, that the legislature can make certain facts elements, and we do generally defer to the legislature's decision to make certain things elements versus not. And well, some states do.
And I understand what you're saying, but isn't it more not a legislative decision, but maybe our decision as to what burden of proof would apply? That wouldn't be something the legislature would. But you're saying making it an element would therefore make it a higher burden.
That's
right. But counsel, can't you do that without making it an element? You cite in your brief several times the case of State versus Sanders, but you don't refer to paragraph 51. And there the court wrote this. We agree that in the absence of a defendant's admission that he or she has been previously convicted of a qualifying offense, the state must prove prior convictions beyond a reasonable doubt in order to satisfy the proof requirements under 973.12.1. The burden of proof, beyond a reasonable doubt, I'm inserting that, applies both to the existence of a conviction and the date of conviction. So haven't we decided that in Sanders?
This court declined to apply that burden of proof and import it into the OWI penalty enhancement statute in the Weideman case. So,
counsel, are you done yet?
Yes.
Okay. Wisconsin's a little bit of a different animal in this regard because we are the only state that has first offense still be in the realm of a civil violation. So if we were to say prior offenses have to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, wouldn't that eliminate a civil offense from counting?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because I think it's the fact of the prior offense that would have to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt versus in that initial offense, whatever elements are needed to violate the law is under the civil forfeiture standard, which is the clear and convincing.
You'll have to explain to me how the Weideman case, which was decided before the Sanders decision, changes the Sanders decision.
In the Weideman case, I believe this court declined to adopt the proof requirements from that other statute into the OWI penalty enhancement scheme. So although the Saunders decision may modify the other burden of proof or develop that burden of proof language, there's no grounds for this court to now import that standard of proof requirement into the OWI penalty enhancement scheme. And this court has generally declined to mandate a particular burden of proof at sentencing, leaving it to the circuit court's discretion. In the McAllister case, this court said that the state needs to use competent proof and prove the existence of the prior conviction to the judge's satisfaction.
And Weideman was decided in 1996 with a 206 cite. Sanders is a 255 cite and stands for the proposition that prior convictions for purposes of repeater enhancer must be proved beyond a reasonable doubt.
I would just say that what I said earlier, Your Honor, that we do not use the burden of proof for other repeater statutes in the OWI penalty enhancement statute. And there is a reasonable, rational basis for that distinction. It's in the legislature's broad discretion to decide perhaps OWI repeaters. It's a repeater statute that's focused on a particular type of crime as opposed to a general repeater statute, which allows for any felony conviction or any three misdemeanors within the past 5 years to be counted. OWI is a particularly dangerous crime. It's a problem in Wisconsin, and it makes sense for the legislature to perhaps focus on people who commit the same type of crime over and over, and that crime in particular, the OWI crime in particular. And I would like to note that the expunction statute itself specifically states that the Department of Transportation must keep these records of drivers' OWI convictions. That suggests that the legislature wanted this information to be available and usable by law enforcement. And counsel pointed to the provision about the Secretary of the Department of Transportation's revocation of someone's license, and that is not the exclusive use for these OWI convictions. Section 343.24 obviously contemplates law enforcement usage outside of the Secretary of the Department of Transportation, allowing governmental entities, such as county DAs, to search these records free of charge. The other issues in this case, as we've already touched on, are resolved by settled law. The McAllister decision clearly controls here and was correctly decided. The two post-McAllister changes in the law that Mr. Braunschweig cites don't create the special justification that this court's stare decisis jurisprudence requires. The creation of this prohibited alcohol concentration charge, first of all, doesn't affect Mr. Braunschweig's case because his CAC was 0.16, which is prohibited by regardless of the number of his prior convictions. And any concerns that he has are resolved already by this court's Alexander decision. And the legislature's decision to make 4+ OWI convictions a felony only matters to the extent that it increases the punishment for the crime. And as Your Honor already asked about, the increase in punishment alone is not sufficient to make a fact of prior conviction an element. In the Almendarez-Torres case, the prior conviction there increased the punishment from a maximum of 2 to 20 years. And the U.S. Supreme Court did not have a problem with that. They did not hold that that made the prior conviction an element. And Mr. Braunschweig does not dispute that the state's provision of Mr. Braunschweig's certified driving record was competent proof of his prior conviction. And the state proved it to the judge's satisfaction as required by McAllister.
Do you think if this were someone who'd had enough convictions that the level of alcohol prohibited by statute would be down to 0.02, that is a fact that has to be proved by the jury, that there was a 0.02 level of blood alcohol?
I believe that's the Alexander case, Your Honor.
Yes, right.
That if that were the case, it would be proven to the jury.
Okay, so that fact would be proven to the jury. But in order to have that fact presented to the jury, is there any preliminary showing that has to be made that this particular person who was charged has a history such that that fact matters? In other words, do you have to show the priors? Otherwise,
yes.
If you don't show the priors, the O2 doesn't matter. It's not O2 unless you've got enough priors, right?
That's right, you're right.
Okay, so how do you fit together the fact that you have to have a number of prior convictions before the jury would find, yeah, you had an O2 or no, you didn't have an O2? And secondly, is it the jury or the judge who finds the determination of sufficient priors?
So in that situation where the alcohol concentration is between 0.02 and 0.08,
yeah.
I believe that even in the information or the complaint under Wisconsin statute for informations and complaints, the potential penalties and the existence of those prior convictions has to be included there.
Okay.
And I think that all of that evidence would be presented to the jury. Perhaps there could be a bifurcated proceeding where the jury determines the existence of the prior convictions and then evidence is put on about the alcohol concentration.
Okay, really? Well, if the jury determines the prior convictions, do they determine them beyond a reasonable doubt because it's a crime, or do they determine it by clear and convincing for that circumstance?
In the status element situation, I believe the Alexander decision says beyond a reasonable doubt that those prior convictions must be.
So then the burden you're arguing to us doesn't fit with all OWIs. It only fits with those that are at the lower end of the spectrum. Is that correct? I mean, you're asking for clear and convincing is the standard of proof.
Oh, no.
You're
no,
not.
Sorry, I should clarify that.
Okay,
the state is just asking this court to find that the state put forth competent proof of the prior conviction sufficient to satisfy the circuit court judge at sentencing.
And right, but that has to be at some level. I mean, even if you're doing a civil case, it's preponderance of the evidence. You got to have some level of proof. We don't just say, well, this may be good enough. The question is, good enough for what?
That I think this court, though, in the past has declined to impose a particular burden
right.
of proof on judges at sentencing. But the state's argument is that a preponderance standard satisfies the due process constitutional concerns.
Okay.
For the question then was for the lower level as well as the higher level?
No, Your Honor. So for 0.02 to 0.08, that is controlled by this court's Alexander decision because the alcohol concentration isn't prohibited unless the priors exist. And that's not the case here with an alcohol concentration of 0.16. It would be prohibited regardless of the
Isn't
number of prior convictions.
Isn't that a hodgepodge then? You have what is the case, Van Sickle? That's not the name of the case. Neil Nedersheim wrote it in 1996. What was the name of that?
Van Ryder?
Yes.
Van Riper.
Van Riper, yeah. So Van Riper, you have beyond a reasonable doubt also. I know it's a PAC, but so you're just going back and forth, and there's a little hesitancy to create such confusion with a hodgepodge like that.
In the Van Riper case, I don't believe the Court of Appeals decided the issue of the appropriate burden of proof.
I think they did in paragraph 2.
If I recall that case. Correct? You're saying yes.
That's correct.
Paragraph 2. We hold that Van Riper's DOT certified driving transcript was admissible evidence and the transcript established Van Riper's repeater status as an element of the PAC offense beyond a reasonable doubt.
I believe the holding in that sentence is that the transcript established the PAC offense beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yes,
and
that's what I said.
Sorry if I'm mischaracterizing it, Your Honor. I think that the holding is that the transcript, regardless of what the constitutionally required burden of proof at sentencing is, the transcript established it beyond a reasonable doubt. And I don't believe the Court of Appeals reasoned through what the appropriate burden of proof is. They just, I believe as Justice Dallet said, assumed that if that were the case, this transcript was sufficient.
So it's sort of like the trial judge here who said, I'm applying clear and convincing, but even if it's beyond reasonable doubt, that burden has been met as well.
That's right. Okay. That's right, Your Honor.
So applying a burden of beyond a reasonable doubt doesn't hinder the state in any way if they can use these certified transcripts to prove it, right?
In this case, no, it wouldn't hinder the state. And I would guess that Your Honor's intuition and experience is correct, that in many of these OWI cases, this certified DOT transcript is what's used to prove these convictions. But I don't think that a beyond a reasonable doubt standard is constitutionally required.
Understanding the court could still apply it, but your argument is that we don't need to.
That's right, Your Honor. That's right. And, of course, exempting cases unlike Mr. Braunschweig's that are controlled by the Alexander decision.
So those would have a different standard than this one, as we talked about.
Right. That's right.
Okay.
And I think that there would be a distinction there, too, between the OWI and PAC, that OWI kind of rides along, if as it were.
Counsel, in State versus Saunders, didn't we recognize that the standard established in Weidman is not being disturbed? So in paragraph 32, we said, in the companion cases of State versus Weidman and Spaeth, we held that the state's proof requirements for showing that a defendant is a repeat offender for the purposes of 346.65, blah, 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 are not governed by 973.12. In particular, we held that prior OWI or OAR offenses may be proved by either a defendant's submission, whether given personally or imputed through counsel, or by the state placing before the court reliable documentary proof of each conviction. Yeah?
I think that's right, Your Honor.
All right. So that, so we've recognized that there's a dichotomy in the level of proof, and we specifically said in Saunders, we're not disturbing the Weidman burden of proof, right?
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay.
And as I said before, I think that justification is warranted as a policy choice by the legislature, that perhaps under the general repeater statute, because the crimes are of different varieties and they're not OWI, which is a particular problem in Wisconsin, it's okay for that difference to exist. If there are no further questions, the circuit court here did not make any mistakes. This court should affirm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have limited time, and there were so many good questions that I'd like to put my two cents in on. I'm going to try and focus on why I focused on McAllister as a third possible issue from the beginning of this case, and its history, and it has to do in part with the question Your Honor asked at the end there regarding Weidman. In 1982, when Mr. McAllister committed his offense, there was no PAC charge. This court noted that in a footnote in that decision, that the newly created PAC charge is going to take effect. I quoted extensively from Weidman in my reply before this court, because the issue came back up in Weidman as an expression of due process or equal protection concerns. And in affirming that, at 206 was second, 106, 107, the court in Weidman recited the reasons why it wasn't a due process or equal protection problem. And the reasons were, these aren't legislative choices. This isn't a legislative policy decision. This court says that choice to impose lesser requirements by the legislature is not a problem because of the large number of offenses, and the enhanced penalties are all just misdemeanors, short periods of incarceration, moderate fines. So we're okay with the efficient administration of justice under that circumstance. That's what this court said in Weidman in 96. Well, since then, we've gone through a whole slew of different adjustments to the PAC, the ability to be charged as a felon as low as a third offense if there's a child in the car. So the reasons that this court said in Weidman, and I'll quote the court, for these reasons we hold that there is no due process or equal protection violation when the legislature imposes different proof requirements for repeat OWI offenders and repeat under the general repeater statute. The reasons were that they were all misdemeanors. They were moderate jail sentences, moderate fines. That was more than 20 years ago. And as someone who has practiced in this area of law during that entire time, and as some of the judges on this court that were circuit judges, some of the justices on this court that were judges know, the law has ratcheted down incredibly. So I assumed we were going to get back to McAllister, and it relates to the expunction question because in Leitner, this court said you can't use an expunged conviction to enhance as a basis for a repeater. McAllister says this is just another repeater. Weidman affirms that because at the time of Weidman, it was all misdemeanor stuff. Okay?
Does this line of analysis require that we accept your characterization of expunction as expunging the conviction and not just the record, the court's record of the conviction?
I want to say yes and no, because I think that was another question I wanted to answer when Justice Ziegler was asking about other things that can be used as a conviction. Some of the things are records of convictions from tribal courts, from other jurisdictions, and that's where you go to 340.01.48M. And it doesn't say the conviction is the laundry list of things under 9R. It says it's a record of conviction as transmitted by the court. So I'm not trying to be cagey with Your Honor. I agree with you in the way that you're arguing the point, but I think that expunction takes care of that record of conviction. The JOC is gone. And I think that's what's at least an open question under Leitner that the court would need to clarify. I think that the final word I would say is that I think that if you want to look for legislative intent, look at 967055 and 973015. 055 says vigorous prosecution of OWI offenses. And they list things not that can't be done by a trial judge, but can't be done without a finding that they're in the public interest. Expunction's not among those things at all. If you look at 973.015, it specifically references and incorporates 343.23, not 343.24 or any other of the numerous things that these records are able to be used for. It incorporates 343.23. So I would argue to find that expunction doesn't take care of this OWI conviction in the way that I argue is picking up a pen and writing a sub-E to 340.019R that adds expunction to the list of things that count as convictions. Thank you.